I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. A new book chronicles the half-century history of Sierra Club BC. Its author, Diane Pinch, joins me now. We'll discuss Passion and Persistence, 50 years of the Sierra Club in British Columbia, 1969 to 2019. It looks at the genesis of this organization in this province, its roots down the coast, and just what it sought out to accomplish. There's been a lot, including the protecting 15% of BC's land base and just over 3% of BC's marine areas. Ms. Pinch chronicles the early activism as well as the people involved, some who continue in the organization, as well as those who've gone on to leave or gone elsewhere, such as politics or journalism. The 1993 war in the woods in Clackawatt Sound is an important time in the province's history, and Sierra Club BC played an important part in various environmental issues like that, the opposition to the Site C Dam and the Trans Mountain Pipeline, among others. Diane Pinch is a retired psychologist and longtime volunteer with Sierra Club BC. I'll ask her about these past 5 years as she's dug through the archives and interviewed many unforgettable members of Sierra Club BC, many of which are featured in this book, which is published by Harbor. She joined me from Victoria last month. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Diane Pinch. Ms. Pinch, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So before 1969, obviously the Sierra Club was in other parts of North America. Is that right?
Just in the United States, yes.
I see.
It was mainly an American organization at that time.
And what's fascinating as I read your book, Passion and Persistence, is that its genesis, the West Coast, wasn't it? Of the United States?
Yes, California. I mean, it started to try and protect the Sierra Nevadas. That's why it's called the Sierra Club.
Right, right. The other thing I wondered about was why it was a club, and it remains a club. I mean, is it really?
Well, I guess it started off, they really wanted to introduce people to the outdoors, and so often what they did is they took people on trips to the outdoors. So it was like they thought of it more as a club to get people out there and enjoying nature and while educating them about what needed to be protected.
Right, right. The BC part of it, the Sierra Club BC, started in 1969, and I really enjoyed the context that you provide at the beginning of the book in terms of what was happening around the world. The 60s were obviously very turbulent shows a necessity of it, especially in British Columbia. What were some of the concerns then that really got the Sierra Club started in this part of the world, say?
Well, again, most of the people that were keen on starting the group were outdoors people. And they were noticing that there was a lot of things happening to places that they loved to go hiking and fishing in.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the areas was, started in Vancouver, so they were concerned about areas close to Vancouver. One of the first areas was Cypress Bowl. People loved to go skiing there, and there was a suggestion of making it into a ski resort, but it seemed to be more of a way just to log the area and clear-cut it, so they really got perturbed about that. And then the other area that was really close to Vancouver was the Skagit Valley. The Seattle Power Company wanted to dam the area on the Washington side,
uh-huh.
which was going to go affecting areas on the BC side, so they really got perturbed about that. There's also a lot of logging happening, so the group that started up in Victoria not too long after the Vancouver group was really concerned about all the areas on the island that were starting to be clear-cut. There's really devastating forestry practices happening at that time, so they were trying to let the public know what was going on and trying to make changes in that area.
You know, the preface of your book is written by Elizabeth May, and she asks a fascinating question in terms of were it not for the Sierra Club, how different BC would be, and how, for the worse, wouldn't it?
Oh, I think so. I mean, Sierra Club, you know, never worked all by itself. It worked with a variety of other people, but it made a whole host of changes to try and protect areas from industrialization, mining and logging, and did a lot of protection of the marine areas. So I think it would be a sad kind of province if these groups weren't around.
Yeah, you write in the book at least 15% of land is protected, 3% of marine area in BC, right?
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
And you can trace that back to the Sierra Club's advocacy. You mentioned a moment ago working in concert with other groups. Is a great list in the back of your book of the organizations that the Sierra Club has worked with over the years, over these 50 years. What was the conditions on which they would cooperate, say, with another group?
I think from the very beginning, they always were cooperating. It's not necessarily there were conditions, but they wanted to ally with other people that to try and broaden the base to show that there was a lot of public support. And in later years, you know, they're trying to not duplicate what each of the groups are doing because there are a vast number of groups, and so the organizations work together to try and pick out what they are really competent at doing and work together.
And the idea of no civil disobedience, no violence, and the sort, was that something that the Sierra Club, say, had in mind from the beginning?
Oh, yes. Sierra Club in the U.S. has been around since 1892, and that has always been a premise of the group, is not to endorse civil disobedience. And then when it came to Canada, you know, that same idea came with it.
Yeah. You talk in the book, there are marvelous profiles throughout your book of people integral to the Sierra Club over the years, and I was fascinated to read the profiles of those from who were there from the beginning, say 50 years ago. A lot of them are still around, aren't they?
There's a few. I felt really privileged to be able to talk with them. Yeah, it's amazing. Sadly, two of the people I did talk to have now since passed away,
right.
So I felt really lucky to catch them before they left us. They were in their 90s when I talked to them, but they were still, you know, keen environmentalists right up to the end.
Yeah, and then there were some who parted with the Sierra Club over the years and not amicably. You talked to them as well, right?
Yes. It's, you know, there's lots of things that happen over the years, different personalities, different conflicts, but no matter what, people want to protect the environment. That's what their passion was, and I think important just to get that history out of what has happened over these past 50 years. It's not just the history of Sierra Club, it's the history of BC, really.
Yeah, indeed. Now, I understand it took you about 5 years to work on this project, is that right?
Yes. I had been retired, and I was looking for some kind of project to work on that I thought would be fascinating, and I realized it would be this 5 years' time would be the 50th anniversary, so that end date was always in my mind, so I made sure I had it done within 5 years.
Yeah, and so the interviews especially fascinated me because you get to talk to people from the past, and they're able to reflect on the important work that they've done over the years. What was your approach in terms of talking to them and asking them about their experience? I mean, you must have found that fun as well as, say, mining the archives and piecing together this history, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, I thought that was the most interesting part of the whole process, was talking to people. I talked to over 30 people. And I wanted to get a broad range of all the different decades and the different kinds of campaigns. So I think I got a broad overview of what was going on. But it was just so interesting to talk to them. I mainly just had a conversation with them. I wanted to find out, you know, what they thought were their highlights that happened during that time. What were their challenges? You know.
Yeah.
And actually I was really curious about what enable them to persist with things? Because some of these campaigns went on for so long, so many years, and I wanted to know how they could maintain their drive to keep going.
Yeah. And that's the fascinating thing, is that when something is so important as the environment, I mean, there's no reason not to persist, eh?
Yeah, I mean, these people were passionate about what they're doing, and yeah, they thought it was very important. Well, still is important, and many of them are still trying to do something in some way.
Yeah, and throughout the province, you really did get to cover a wide gamut of land. I mean, not just the coast here, where you and I live on. But as well, I mean, there was the woman in who stopped mining in one part of the province.
Yeah, Katie Madsen.
Yeah,
very interesting. Yeah,
right.
In the Okanagan area.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. She had come up from California, and she had joined the Sierra Club down there when she was 11 years old. She died when she was 96. She maintained her membership the whole time, so she was an 85-year member of Sierra Club.
Yeah. The other thing that I enjoyed in reading your book is that you chronicle throughout these 50 years how the method, say, or the how the campaigning has changed. Because I mean, it starts off, say, as a sort of, you know, taking local concerns to local authorities and the sort, and raising concerns with the local populace. But some of these campaigns take on greater meaning around the world, don't they?
Yes. Yeah, one of the... Well, certainly, people became very concerned probably during the 90s with the old growth forest being logged. That was a big concern, and there were boycotts across, you know, around the world trying to stop that. Great Bear Rainforest, that's a 20-year campaign that went on. I think that's become a role model for other areas of what can be done to protect areas. It's not just trying to make them into a park, but to try and have some kind of model where you can maintain a sustainable economy, because people live in these areas, and that, so they came up with a new model of how you can work to protect areas, but also, you know, allow people to have some kind of jobs at the same time.
Yeah. You mentioned Clackwat Sound. I was 10 when all that happened, and so, you know, but I remember hearing about it every day and the sort. And it's interesting to read in your book just how the Sierra Club managed to, say, harness public opinion on that issue and managed to do it quite effectively, because I mean the change, you can see the change happen over a quick period of time, don't you?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I mean Sierra Club was not the one out on doing the boycotts,
right?
Not the boycotts, but
the protests and the sort
protests.
Of, right? Yeah.
But they were there. They had one of the things that they did was the mapping program.
Mm.
Vicky Husband got the money to put together the technology and the person that could make these maps. And that can just visually show people, you know, the devastating changes that had happened in a very short time. It really galvanized the public to try and advocate for change.
Yeah, that worked so well. Mm-hmm. I remember seeing some of those maps, you know, on the news and seeing them in classrooms. People would bring them in, you know, at a young age, and then how effective that was on us as in our formative years.
Well, Sierra Club's been really involved with bringing education into the school system, too.
Mm-hmm.
Jan Hoffman started that in 1998, so it's quite an active program the Sierra Club has. So they know that, you know, educating the youth makes a difference to the rest of the public, too.
Yeah. The interesting thing as I was reading the book was seeing a lot of names associated with the Sierra Club over the years who went on to other things. You know, a name early on that people in Vancouver say will recognize is Gordon Price.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have George Heyman later on, Sarah Cox. Elizabeth May, of course, was associated with the national version of the Sierra Club.
That's right.
A lot of these, I mean, 50 years ago, I don't think a lot of people would have thought that people associated with the organization would go on to, say, positions of influence elsewhere.
Well, I think Sierra Club is actually a very good training ground for people that, want to go on to do other work. It shows people how they can work to educate the public, how to work with the media, how to change people's opinion, how to work within the system. Sierra Club has always wanted to work with, or always tries to work within the system, no matter who's in power. They try and, change the thought process of what's going on to make change. So it's a good place to start off and learn how to do these kinds of things.
And there's also a personal connection for you. Your husband Brian, he was involved right from the beginning, was he?
Pretty close to the beginning when it started in Victoria. Yes. So I met him shortly after in 1975, and he was quite an active campaigner at that point, and he's continued to be involved over the years. Was on the board and in various capacities. So ever since I met him, and we've been together for over 40 years. Mm-hmm. Sierra Club has been a part of our life.
The other thing that struck me as I was reading the book is you've talked to people obviously who have been involved with the organization for nearly their lifetime. The sense of optimism that they have, I mean, that remains, even though it can be very easy to be, less hopeful with mm-hmm. everything that's going on around the world. Would you talk about just what, how the people you've talked with over the years, people you've had experience with over the years, how they've managed to retain a sense of hope still, despite the despair around us?
Well, it's interesting. I think that's why it's important to belong to some kind of organization like Sierra Club, because I talk to them and people within the group, they really support each other. So, some people, they'll go for a period of time when they're feeling really down about things. Things aren't going where they want it to go, but someone else in the group can sort of build them back up again and say, let's think out of the box and let's try it a slightly different way. And Sierra Club, one of the things I think that's really on people's minds now is climate change.
Right.
And so one of the things that they've come up recently is with that document, The Future is Here, and that's how I end the book, with that abridged version of that document, which I'm hoping will show that there are practical things that can be done,
uh-huh.
and that there can be some optimism and hopefulness about where we're going, and what we need is some kind of political will, a willingness to make that change. And Sierra Club, tries to show what's possible, and they just need everybody to sort of get on board and work towards that vision.
Yeah, a lot of people, view climate change as an emergency, obviously,
mm-hmm.
but at the same time, that can say, I don't know, unmotivate you, if you will, in terms of doing something or thinking that you can do something in the interim. But again, the title of the book really says it all. The passion and the persistence that one will have, realizing just how important the environment is.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of the day, that's what keeps everyone going, right?
I think so. Yeah. Like, Rick Careless is one of the people I talk about in the book. He's quite he still works really hard to do what's needed. And he's got a poster on his wall of Winston Churchill,
uh-huh.
Winston Churchill saying, never give up. And that's what many of these people believe. You can't give up. We have to keep working to protect what we've got, what we have.
Yeah. And the future of the Sierra Club, that's going to go on for another 50 years in British Columbia, certainly, right?
I think so. It's pretty strong right now. I think it's doing really well.
Yeah.
It's also survived. I mean, it can easily be subsumed by other organizations, but it's retained its sort of independence throughout it all, right? I mean, this is a part of the world where you know, there's just a surfeit of different environmental organizations, but they've remained constant, haven't they? They will, right?
I think so. They've got their own niche, how they work. You know, they work. One of the things they really believe in is it's important to be credible and to have a scientific research behind them. And so even though they sometimes work in the background and other groups are more in the forefront, they really make sure that they quite often are the ones that provide the scientific reports behind it to say this is why we may need to do things a little differently. This is why this is a problem area.
Right. Diane, it's been a pleasure speaking with you today. You know, you are right. This is indeed a history of the province. You've done a great service, not only for the Sierra Club, but as well as BC in terms of chronicling it. I appreciate your time today. Thanks for this.
Well, thank you very much.
The book is called Passion and Persistence, 50 Years of the Sierra Club in British Columbia. It is from Harbor Publishing. Its author, Diane Pinch, joined me on the line from Victoria in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.